Okay, I hope I see some biologists here. I'm going to try to speak at least to them to some extent. I am actually from Boston University, by the way, the webpage at Brown. Unless Chung Yi, who's just become chairman, offers me a job by the end of this talk, I'm from there. Okay. When I first came here on Sunday, I met some people who said that they were working on brains, and I thought, gee, there was another string conference I wasn't aware of. So as in all the subjects, one has to be careful with terminology. We have brains, but they're B-R-A-N-E rather than B-R-A-I-N. And we're going to talk about glue. And if I recall, somebody once told me that in the brain, things are held together by a sticky stuff called glia. Is that correct? Anybody know? Nobody's going to confirm this. Okay. I was told that. Well, okay. Sorry, but there's stuff.
It's the wrong verb. It's the wrong verb.
Isn't it called glia? No.
The thing other than the neurons are called glia.
Yeah, the stuff in between. Okay. So here we're going to have stuff in. Oh, sorry. Hold. Well, okay. We don't know what holds together quarks yet either. But here it's called glue. We're going to talk about the proton and proteins, which I think comes from the same root. That's
the correct analogy that's given here, the dark matter of the brain.
Ah, okay. Maybe that's it. All right, so let me start off. How do I erase this thing? Let me start off in a sort of Scientific American mode by starting with minus 100 years, which is a date which is quite interesting because it's just before Einstein blew the lid off of beginning of the physics century. And when we had that, and I want to talk about what we knew. I'm going to go rapidly through the dates, by the way. My history is very poor anyway. What we knew about forces. Now, as you all learned, that there are four forces, one, two, three, and infinity. And this is electromagnetism. And this is weak. And this is strong. And this is gravity. But at the turn of the century, basically, all we knew is that gravity was the first thing we learned something about, that the force was 1 over r squared. They knew the electrostatic force was also 1 over r squared. And this was some mysterious action at a distance. But here we had Maxwell's equations. And so we had local fields, E and B. But along came Einstein and realized that the speed of light was the speed of light. And therefore, one should actually talk in relativistic terms. So the first thing was to add relativity to the mix. And you all know more or less what happens here. It means that you should associate three space dimensions and one time dimension into a four vector. And everything should always have four components or multiples thereof, like this. And C plays a special role. And whenever you have a constant, this plays a special role in physics. It's like to set it equal to 1 to obscure things. So now time and space is the same, right? That's nice. It's not quite the same. This is sort of complex space. Now, once you've gotten to this form, it's nice to write Maxwell's equation in terms of a tensor. And the tensor basically has E's like here. I'm going to do this very crudely. And B is here. And it's anti-symmetric. And it's 4 by 4. And it's called the field strength. And if you do a quick calculation of how many independent components there are in a 4 by 4 tensor, you'll discover that there are 3 plus 3 equals 6. And then, So what we had was one relativistic theory here and one odd man out. Now, if we go forward, also at this time, it was realized that there was a quanta and there was H bar. So quantum mechanics began slightly to merge, but it really didn't come into fruition until much later. And quantum mechanics does many things, but it kind of associates momentum with derivatives with respect to x, or it tells you how much you can determine the famous uncertainty principle, momentum and x. Simultaneously, therefore, your transforms of each other. You can't be in both spaces simultaneously, so you gotta lose one when you gain the other. And then that leads to the next constant, so we set that to 1. And now you're in a unit system which there's no distinction between space and time, but there's also no distinction between masses or the famous energy, relation of Einstein. The relation, Einstein's relation, of course, is E equals M, which is complete topology. C squared is 1, right? So now we're in a space where basically there's only one thing. There's a length, or that can be thought of as 1 over energy or 1 over mass. Now, that's the reason that we call this field high-energy physics, because we were trying to explore shorter and shorter distances. And when we go to higher energies, we're looking into the microstructure of basic forces, okay? And so you look farther and farther. Anyway, as time went on, there was an awareness that the neutron decayed spontaneously, and so did most nuclei. And this was called the weak force, not understood at all in any fundamental way. But finally, there was the nuclear force here, which is very, very strong. And the funny thing about this is lots of things, carbon atoms, helium, etc., all these things have strong forces. But then clearly everybody appreciated that nuclei are really collections of neutrons and protons, so they're not very basic. But when you put these things together, you discover, and you hit them off of each other, you define more and more fragments which are strongly interacting in some sense. And so at the end of this, which I'm now getting to what I would say is minus 50 years, we had a scorecard where you had been able to combine relativity and quantum mechanics into one successful theory called QED. So that was OK. You had no real successful theory of quantum theory for weak interactions, no successful theory quantum theory for strong interactions, no successful local quantum field theory for gravity. So if you were a student even in the 60s, and you were being told that all you should do is learn very thoroughly what Feynman had taught us about quantum field theory and this clearly successful electromagnetism quantized and made relativistic, after whatever, 50, 60 years from the beginning, you had 3 failures and 1 success. So there began to be, Dave is objecting to my...
Okay.
I was supposed to be able to, That's right. When I'm saying this, I'm overstating this, but the point is there wasn't a theory which was in any way complete. Even QED has problems by itself, so maybe you should really give them all partial credit rather than my careful pass-fail approach. But my point is the following. It became fashionable, a trend, to look at this terribly complicated strong dynamics here and ask if there wasn't a totally new way to accommodate what was clearly the 2 basic principles of the first half of the 20th century, quantum mechanics and relativity, and not follow very closely the lead of electromagnetism and the successful theory of quantum electrodynamics. And that approach, in hindsight, looks somewhat like desperation, but it went under the name of S-matrix. And it was just to say, let's start all over again and see if we can build quantum amplitudes and see what kind of regularity they have. So what was the regularity that one was seeing? Well, it was very hard to find any. But this huge plethora of states here got to be plotted along 2 important axes, the masses of the states and the spin, or J. And it was discovered that while the states went up in mass, they formed series on relatively straight lines. That was observation 1. The other was that while it's true that as you went up in mass, they became more and more fragile. So for example, the rho is the first one up, and it can decay into 2 parts. They didn't become alarmingly fragile. They still seemed like fairly respectable what was called elementary particles at that time. What do you mean by that? You mean that the width of decay over the mass was, in fact, maintaining a relatively small number. I'll call it a tenth. But let me go now and show you data. By the way, a lot of my talk here so that it doesn't become unmanageable for those who are not part of the technical effort is going to show you data. I got to get this onto the right form here. This beautiful laptop is supposed to allow me to see it both on the screen and here. Okay, so here is a not a terribly great slide, but here is a chart, like I was saying, that as you looked up at mass, you were getting more and more particles, and they were also getting up in spin. Maybe I should say as an aside, of course, the photon, this is all in h-bar units, h-bar is 1, and the photon is spin 1, the graviton, if it exists, is spin 2, so we know that we have theories with spin, and this electron and proton and so on are spin 1/2. So, but what we're seeing here is a growth of more and more states of higher and higher spin, but also this regularity that they're very close to being on straight lines. And so this plot here, it's called the Regé plot, was some hint at regularity in this zoo of complicated physics. That is the so-called mesons or even spin objects. You take two different hadrons, say pi nucleon, you look for when it forms this state.
That's right.
This is real data as best as it can. It's not a terribly good plot with error bars, but it's all real data. The boxes is a crazy preprint theory. Sorry, the dots are real data, and here the dots are real data. It's funny, I tried to find good Regé stuff, and this was a couple of years ago, and you could find almost nothing on the web because it had almost died. I think that's the width here. Here is the nucleon data. There is better data, but I couldn't find one that was easy to project. Amazingly enough, now when you look on the web, you can see a fair amount of reinspection of this data. Okay, now, let me show you this, however, which is sort of amusing. I hadn't seen a plot done this way. Here's the nucleon system, okay? And here is a curve through the widths. Now, that's a hard plot to understand because the width is in mass units, and this is in mass squared. So let me replot it this way. Here is linear in mass against spin. And here's linear in mass against width. And if you look at some line from 0 up to here, you see indeed these widths are approximately 1/10 of their mass. What? Oh, it's just the left-hand side of this curve. These are two different parities. There's a story here that there's almost parity degeneracy in the nucleons, something which is not well understood. Parity is broken by, this is one of the questions, in fact, which Bob Jaffe put to string theorists at a workshop not too long ago, saying we should understand why this parity degeneracy is nearly exact.
Integrability.
What? Integrability. All right, good. Look, we already answered one question in the workshop. That's great. Okay. So anyway, the point is that you had these very smooth lines through the masses, and the masses were real states that were not so broad that you obviously could identify them, but they didn't seem to get a lot broader as you went up into energy. So there is some small parameter, and that's what, of course, one hopes to find when one gets going. So let me take this away. So this search for a new theory started off in a very humble form. Namely, you looked at a single scattering process with two particles coming in and two particles going out, and for the sake of, this is not a real process you could do, but the lightest hadron is a pion, so let's suppose that we were able to somehow build pion beams and scatter them off, and in goes the pion. And this has incoming total energy, E, or that is essentially what people dub S, so-called Mandelstam variable. And then this is going to scatter off at some angle, and there is a corresponding variable T. Now, it's one of the beauties of relativistic quantum mechanics is that even if you have a simple diagram like this, you have a diagram where two things scatter and exchange, say, on a row, that this diagram can say this comes off at time one and delays and goes there at time two. But the same diagram, as Feynman taught us, really can be viewed in the opposite time order with an antiparticle going the other way. And when you generalize that, you can actually look at this process and even reverse the lines so that these two are regarded as in and those out. And then T plays exactly the energy role this way, and S plays the angular role that way. And indeed, the amplitude for this is entirely symmetric in these two variables. And the phenomenology that this regipole had was that at very large energy, it was parameterized by a very simple function, which I'll write down. This is about the only equation, well, maybe a couple equations I'll expect you to, where this function alpha was in fact just this linear function through the resonances. And in fact, in this case, this would be the first one to be rho. And this gamma function, gamma is the famous thing, which is a smooth version of n factorial. Oh. Thank you. What am I going to say? I should really do one if I was going to be very careful. For the row, I would do one here. And this actually has a pole, which is the sign of these resonances. And indeed, if the first resonance is in fact a row, then the first pole would be at J equals to 1. Now, it was noticed, it isn't quite changing history, but it was essentially noticed by Veneziano in the famous step to the string theory, that you could symmetrize this formula here. The left-hand side is symmetric. This is the approximation at high energy, which in fact, when I was a graduate student, was being written on the blackboard everywhere. So you say, what if I just wrote this down and forced symmetry? Now, if you know Stirling's approximation, and I won't do it for you, it is easy to show that indeed, as energy goes to infinity, I get back to this, quote, Reggie form. But obviously, if I were to turn this around and let this be energy variable and fix this, I would get the behavior in the, quote, cross channel. And so it'd have simultaneously this phenomenological observation and this exact statement of symmetry. And as they say, the rest was history. The fact is that this approximation, where you took a rigid linear function for this thing, turned out to be a reasonable phenomenology precisely for the idealized case where there is no width to these higher and higher states. So it was viewed immediately as a starting point, hopefully, so some kind of perturbative approach to this new phenomenon in strong interactions. But the amazing thing was that this amplitude had such beautiful mathematical properties, this is a simple beta function, that very quickly people found analogous amplitudes for any number of particles, and they kept staring at this mathematics, and it was so nice, it should have a nice interpretation, and gradually people realized, aha, this amplitude was the quantum mechanics, not of a single particle, because it's got this huge plethora of states, but in fact the quantum mechanics of a oscillating string traveling through time with various types of oscillations in which each mode on the string represented the higher and higher states. So this sort of was an accidental discovery, but in a rather amazingly interesting one. Yeah?
How well does this formula approximate the
profile? Well, pretty good in some sense and pretty bad in others. I mean, in fact, I'll get to that. One of the curious observations, which I'm not sure has any meaning at all here, but it was known that this should go to zero when any momentum goes to zero in the, quote, chiral or Adler limit, right? And if you imply, if you demand that, it turns out that this trajectory, rho, has to be fixed. If you just look at the zero, there's a zero coming from the poles in this, right? And so the fact is that it turns out that what you need is an intercept of this trajectory to be exactly a half, which was pretty close to the fits that people were doing at that time and still do. So it had quasi phenomenological results. Now I'm going to switch to QCD and criticize it, so don't let me get over it. In fact, if you can say basically the initial enthusiasm was not called for, okay? It seemed like physics, but clearly there's a lot wrong with it, okay? And to fast forward, this workshop is coming at a time in which people are trying to find out why it was wrong and what might be right from what we now know much more of superstrings. And so it was an inspiration, but somewhat of a dead end at this point.
There was a famous paper by Ludwig.
What was that?
Seven experimental reasons why the Zeno formula fits
in 26 dimensions.
The add and zero were one of
them. Yes, okay, I'm sure. Let me answer the question this way. What? That's part. That's really my talk. But I'll say the buzzword right now. To the extent that this is good at all, it is going to give you some of the long distance physics. It is clearly bad at short distance physics. So I think this formula has a chance of being sort of a long distance approximation to this hoped for discovery that we have not yet made. Okay, but whether it's close to it or not, who knows? By the way, if you look at modern papers on Reggie theory, which are now becoming more and more popular, everyone's studying how this deviates from linearity. So clearly it's not linear, that's even experimentally, and there are many reasons for that. Since you've asked me that, I'll try to go a little bit to the critics. Okay, so now let's get back, now let's get to the next epoch, which came, by the way, almost immediately after this, and that is the discovery of asymptotic freedom, which the chairman of the session had something to do with, and a correct theory, everyone believes, for the strong interactions, namely QCD. Now, all of this bashing of field theory that went into this thing turned out to be completely wrong from the point of view of the strong interactions. It turned out, in fact, that if you took F mu nu and just replaced it with a sort of matrix version of it. To be exact, the potential here, which for electromagnetism has one component and corresponds to my one charge, this matrix becomes a 3x3 object, and there's a reason I labeled strong interactions 3, because it is actually corresponds, so electromagnetism, let me make my chart here, 1. Electromagnetism has 1A and 1 charge. QCD has 3 charges, and the A's, being a 3x3 matrix, are 9, but let's not quibble, it's actually 8. Close, it's traceless. And the 3 objects that it couples to are now viewed as quarks, and there are 3 of them for every name. If you name a quark, an up quark, there are actually 3 different ones. They're charged, and the charges are given red, I don't know, white and blue, depending on what your choice is. And therefore, this number here is called color. And you build a quantum field theory out of these matrix objects. Now, with hindsight, hindsight's great, in the most analogous way one could imagine to QED itself. There are differences one has to do it to make it a gauge theory in this larger space, and those differences are profound, and the results are profound. But the amazing thing is that if you had really understood this, maybe we'd gotten it earlier. And the theory here is called Yang-Mills theory, because it was invented in some rough form prior to QCD itself. And it's rather amusing, actually. It was invented to explain the row, which has three components. Actually, it would have been an N equal 2 version of it. And so this is one of these many cases in history of science where someone invents something for one purpose. It turns out to be irrelevant to that purpose, but the invention is very useful. Okay. By the way, I think in some sense, this wrong invention of string theory can be viewed the same way. This is going to start explaining the row again, a mistake. Probably in a certain sense, this is not the row in its simplest form. It's the gluon. But anyway. Okay. So the point is, we got QCD. What happens when you get QCD? Well, one thing that happens is you can give up on this whole story of trying to find a string for QCD. And indeed, string theory had a near-death experience at this point. But the theory of strings is so pretty that valiant people kept pushing to find out what the consequences were of the theory, whether they, whatever they are. But you can also try to see why this phenomenological amplitude made any sense at all. So we had a small parameter. And it turns out that Tuft noticed that 1 over n, which is actually equal to 1/3, can be thought of as a formal expansion parameter. And if you look at that formal expansion parameter, sure enough, this width, for example, the row, if you imagine how it would be bound with two quarks. And you have enough confidence that QCD is correct, you find, sure enough, this goes to 0. So in fact, the discovery, the search for this small parameter actually led to an identification of a small parameter in Yang-Mills theory in the sense that n is treated as a parameter. Now, like in any expansion, you have to set it back to its physical value before you evaluate things correctly. But nonetheless, this 1 over n expansion explained that that phenomenology might have had some truth in it. Okay. That was the first chapter. So you would say, at this point, it should have revived people's hope between Yang-Mills theory and this phenomenology, and you should keep working on it, and some people did. But the other thing that happened is that string theory started to be looked at much more carefully. And the result of this was interesting, but deviated farther and farther from its motivation here. What happened was you found out that there were massless particles. What you thought was the row was a photon-like particle. There was, in fact, also a closed string. The closed string can oscillate either by attaching itself to quarks and being an open string in this view, or there were closed strings. In this language of Yang-Mills, these are pure glue. So there was also a spin 2 massless particle. That's number one. Number two, it only made sense in d equals 10. Number three, well, they're really related. It had supersymmetry. And all of those things are not properties of QCD, quite obviously. However, the fact that it had a spin 2 object meant that it did have gravity. So the gravity, which was the least understood as a quantum theory, had one realization here in string theory. So most of the people stopped thinking very hard about the possibility of interpreting QCD as a string theory and thought very hard about interpreting string theory as a theory of gravity with a lot of matter, and maybe even a theory that could explain the entire world of elementary particles. So But let me tell you another disaster, and this goes to the question that was asked, what's wrong with this formula? These things, let me say that even in early times, one felt that maybe one could get out of these other things by some trickery. For example, it is well known that in gauge theories, when one has a zero mass particle, you can sometimes distort it. It's called the Higgs mechanism. So you can start off with a theory which has a zero mass particle and hopefully put it in some non-trivial background and get it to be get these masses here to be non-zero. Supersymmetry, we believe, may even be in nature, but nobody says it's exact. Mechanisms of breaking supersymmetry are interesting, not trivial, but certainly something you can try. And finally, 10 dimensions looks most daunting, 9 plus 1. However, when you realize that this starts off life as a theory of gravity, and the salient feature of gravity is that when you turn it on, it changes the geometry of space-time. This is general relativity's basic tenet, that geometry is a secondary feature that comes after you solve gravity. So once you say that you don't know the geometry here, you can hope that there's relatively flat 4 dimensions and some curled up 6 dimensions. And that, and indeed one has to hope for that in any application of string theory. So all of these things were not impossible to imagine working on, but clearly a daunting task. However, one thing that really was daunting is that, and still is that Yang-Mills theory has asymptotic freedom, and its most important feature is that when you scatter at very wide angles, gluons come out, not almost don't come out, don't really come out, but spray momentum out, and the theory becomes like hard little nodules of quanta at short distances. In particular, if you look at my pi-pi scattering at wide angle, this thing actually goes off if I take s to infinity and t to minus infinity, it turns out. That's an angle not equal to 0. This thing actually in QCD goes off like some power, almost. Now again, if you remember Stirling's formula, maybe I'll write it down for you, but not do the exercise for you. Stirling's formula for this at large argument is n to the n minus and when we took one of these large, this exponential behavior canceled between the two, and we got power behavior. But when we take, But when we take two of them large, this goes exponentially down. Disastrously wrong. It's completely unlike QCD. So strings, in their generic form, are incredibly soft when you scatter them hard. Now, in my slides, I should have gone back to it. I called this, quite rightly, the Rutherford experiment. You hit hadrons against each other like nucleons were hit hard, and you try to find out if there's stuff inside by seeing if hard things bounce more or less like billiard balls, right? And here you find that the QCD, Yang-Mills theory, and by the way, data, support this, absolutely, no question. And the theoretical foundation is asymptotic freedom, which is rather solidly understood, so it's really a closed story. And strings in flat space have this. Now, it's ironic because, of course, this is in fact one of the features that made it soft enough to give you finite gravity. So it not only looked like it flew in the face of any application to QCD, it was indeed the virtue which made the superstring, makes the superstring to this day interesting. So, I mean, you're really caught here. If you're going to do anything like a string theory, the phenomenology is dead wrong, and for good reasons. So why did this not die? In fact, it almost did die. The revival of the subject, roughly speaking, and this is what I'll get back to with a little more slides, too. I'll have to take them. Basically, in the 90s, essentially, 30 years after the discovery of string theory, a little more, one generation, revolution, the Vietnam War is going in the 60s, now we're back to the same place. It's a good time to revisit politics and science. Everything comes in cycles. Hopefully not so bad. Maybe we make some progress. At least in string theory we'll make some progress. Here, the increased understanding of string theory was a huge body of literature on how different string vacuum related to each other, and also how non-perturbative phenomena came in. And in particular, there are solutions to the field equations for string theory that have concentrated mass on things called brains as a generalization of the idea of membrane, right? And in particular, if I want to have this collapsing here to 3 plus 1, being special, you can look at an object which is 3 plus 1 dimensions, and here is life, our world. There still are these extra dimensions going out here. In particular, let me identify one as R, and the other five I won't talk about much, but there really are 10 dimensions out there. Now, if you scatter strings in the vicinity of this source, this is a source, a big mass, and it is, after all, a theory of gravity. It's going to know about that. In fact, the way it knows about it in first order is the geometry has changed. The graviton is always trying to go in a straight line. It just doesn't find a very nice geometry to travel in. And if you build up a large mass here, you get a space which is very warped in this direction. And indeed, Maldacena, working on the basis of many other people's contributions, crystallized this in the following picture. You put here n of these objects characterizing this nc. And one feature of these massive objects is that the strings attach to them. Just like we thought they would attach to quarks, here the charges are on those brains, and they attach to the brains. Now, the fact that this thing has this zero mass particle, spin one, means that these things run up and down this surface. And it turns out, with n, it looks exactly like Yang-Mills theory for SUM. I should really say super version of Yang-Mills theory, because these are super strings and a lot of other things come along for the ride. But nonetheless, it turns out that you can stack up these brains here and get a way to find a low energy limit, which is the field theory, which has close to the field theory, like the field theory that we have now for the hadron. On the other hand, it actually has closed strings which live out and don't attach to these, because there's no ends for those charges to glue to. And by a clever scaling of the space, you discover that there is a limit in which these closed strings describe the same physics as the small oscillations of these D brains, of these brains. So in other words, you can be a Yang-Mills person and say, I'm going to study these closed strings running up and down the brains, or you can be a string person and say, I'm going to watch the closed strings floating around in this gravitational field. Now, remember that the closed strings used to have a spin 2 graviton. It turns out that this space, which I will describe more in detail, it's a little bit like a waveguide. You're going to make states run up and down this space, and or if you like a dielectric material. It turns out that when you look at the mode that used to be the graviton and had zero mass, it is no longer zero mass. And it can be plausibly identified with a pure glue object. So let me go back to my slides, because my point here is not to go a lot more into the mathematics, although I'll show you a little bit, but actually to make a point that not only was the original discovery, or the proposal for QCD string driven by data, we fortunately are in a situation of having more data. Now, the data is a little unusual, because the simple situation, which we may have some chance of getting a precise handle on, will be the case where we have infinite number of colors. No problem. We go to a computer. If we can simulate on a computer n equals 3, we can at least do something as n grows large. So let me show you the kind of data which I think is now the new experimental framework. Okay, let me go. Well, here's my picture. I've been drawing it on the board, but here's my picture between closed strings acting like Yang-Mills theory and gravitons bleeding out and becoming blue balls, but it's just a cartoon. So doesn't really fit. This simple setup that Maldacena wrote, if you want to actually see what it does to the space-time, its major effect is this radial coordinate, as I said. And it makes distances, as you go away from this brain, contract. So I'm saying it the wrong way. The distances vary as a function of r, OK? And we will identify the small r as dealing with infrared physics, and the large r with ultraviolet physics. As I said, this original setup here is, in fact, this is a weird thing that PowerPoint has done. That's, yes, for you. That's a calligraphic N turning into a death thing. I said I had a near-death experience. Maybe I was having another near-death experience. Okay. This particular very simple background actually is supersymmetric Yang-Mills, and it's an interesting thing because this theory is quite different from QCD, and one normally did not dream, at least I didn't, that one should think of it in stringy terms. But indeed, this is actually turns out to be a case which can be thought of rather nicely in stringy terms, albeit a little unfamiliar. Okay, let me let me go to data. This is a lattice calculation. This is the spectrum of QCD without any quarks. Now, that's a very funny theory because, of course, all our nuclei, protons, neutrons, they all have quarks in it. But when n goes to infinity, actually these quarks become a small correction, smaller and smaller. So what you end up with is just this gluon-like Maxwell field. And the amazing thing is that instead of it having independent gluons propagating out, it has what's called confinement. And the only thing that that survives are compact objects called blue balls. And they are, from our point of view, hopefully going to be characterized by something like the oscillations of a closed string in this in some background. Okay. Now, this data has actually been improved a little more from this plot. But what I want to point out is that every state below this is known and reasonably accurate. If you develop a string theory and you want to see if it accords with a standard model, you have to get the right states. If you develop a string theory for QCD, you have to get these states and in the right order. You're not even close if you don't.
This is a large N limit?
No, this is not a large N limit. So the question now is how close is it to the large N limit? Indeed, one of the reasons they stop here is two reasons. They'd be harder to do high spins, just technically, but they start to decay. So they become unstable.
These are all stable.
These are stable, that's right. Because this first object here is so massive, there's quite a spectrum that is bound. This is, by the way, Cooney Morningstar and Yuge's data. Oh, Yuge's not there yet. Okay, now, in this background, this is the question of large N. Large N, this was shown actually by Igor as well. Large N does not destroy this picture. Here is N equals 2, and N equals 3 is where that data was at. And infinite N is rather smoothly extrapolated with not very much change in the values. So for qualitative purposes, at this state of the game, it's really pretty good just to have n equals 3 for these stable states. Okay, that's the same one. Okay, now, here is a first attempt by a group of people in this field to use this idea of an extra dimension and D-brains to try to calculate these states. And I'll describe a little bit how they're calculated, but it's not an easy task. It's not calculated any means rigorously, but in a particular limit. But what I want to point out is that as crude as the calculation is, the states that appear are in pretty good correspondence, both in mass and spin and parity, with the actual states that are seen in the data. Now, I should, for honesty, tell you the cheat here. This is a theory in which the extra five dimensions, I said it had four plus this nice radius, the extra dimensions have not been squeezed in such a way as to push the states that vibrate in those directions out of the spectrum. So I take the attitude, which is in fact taken also in lattice gauge theory, at strong coupling. I look for those states that I want to survive in the future limit I hope I can take to the right theory, namely the weak coupling theory or the scaling theory. I ignore all the states which are in other superselection sectors, have charges, which are there, but are not interesting if indeed this is going to correspond to QCD. So that is the big cheat, I just plain filter. Now, if you look at strong coupling in the lattice, you also have all kinds of junk because you're at the cutoff. I'm not really saying you should justify this, but I'm just telling you what you actually do, okay? You simply look at those states that you know. You look at all the states which are color singlets. You don't throw any away that can be there, but you filter out only those states which just couldn't be in the proper subsector of QCD, okay?
The normalization on the left is arbitrary.
The arbitrary normalization is at 2, yeah.
So you have to juggle with
a
3 plus
1. Oh, why? Good question. Why? You know the calculation, then I'll tell you the reason. What?
The same string.
What?
3 plus plus is the same string. So.
Yes, but you're not saying quite right. Somebody said that. Why?
Actually, I was going to ask questions. So
oh, you're right. I can't ask you a question? Mm-hmm. Why is that out? Not in the spectrum.
I thought it was obvious immediately. I mean, you know, the supergravity states don't give you.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. So what's happening is that this calculation, the major approximation, was to take g squared n, which is the effective coupling in this large n limit, and also take it to infinity. And if you look at the relationships, you discover that this slope, for the Reggie slope, is going down. Alpha prime is going to 0. So all recurrences up the trajectory are being pushed out of the spectrum. What that means is that the string is collapsing into its lowest ground state. It cannot rotate orbitally and add orbital momentum from the geometric extent of the string. Therefore, you cannot get the orbital excitations, which are literally in the data. And that's a disease of the calculational method. Yes?
If I understand it correctly, on the left-hand side, this is n equals 4 superangles and large n. Keep those states that you're interested in.
No, I didn't tell you the full story here. Let me tell you. In the spirit of modeling, let me tie this out. The n equals 4 metric has just this simple factor of radial dependence. In the five coordinates that we're interested in. This theory has a boundary at r equals infinity, the other popular variable is 1 over r, and goes deep into the interior at 0 r. This theory has no glue balls because it is a conformal theory. Instead, you introduce a metric with some kind of cutoff here, as was suggested phenomenologically, I mean, was mentioned in Strauss's talk. We actually used a metric here, which has another factor, which is motivated by the so-called Euclidean black hole. Okay. Then, by virtue of trapping these states here, you end up with discrete glue ball states. So it is in fact in the 87 cross S4 M theory version of the Euclidean black hole.
I guess the where I'm coming from is, yeah, should we or shouldn't we be surprised that there's a match? I mean, to what degree, what I mean by that is that you're truncating some theory to, let's say, bosonic spectrum.
Yeah.
Is what we're learning, yes, that particular setup you're talking about, is what much interaction between the states you're interested in and everything else we need to do. That had to happen, of course, to get any kind of match, but what have you really learned from this?
Okay, I mean, obviously one has to be very cautious. I mean, you know, but let me tell you what my optimistic reading of it is. And it's the following, and let me get to go another page here. The states that you see on that chart have to do with these components of the supergravity multiplet. It required every single bosonic field in this sector to have a state in order to get these spin and parity combinations. So it says to me that there's something right about starting with an extreme limit with a supergravity theory, which is to me a surprise because there's no supersymmetry in Yang-Mills in QCD. So I think that's one thing. The other thing is that the fact that in the right order, many attempts to look at large M found you in the wrong phase when you took large M. And you found yourself in a theory which has nothing to do with the theory that you wanted to get to. And this looks close enough to be not pessimistic about. So that's my take on it. That's all.
How much could you have mangled the metric and still got something that wasn't the right order?
Oh, so long as I had these modes, I could have put any metric that basically had a wall and sort of. Yeah, that's right. In fact, that's why Matt, I think, is quite right to just use some phenomenological metric, which is easy to integrate. In fact, we're doing that as well. I don't think the shape is being measured much. After all, the shape requires getting high modes. And in fact, in that graph, we only had one recurrence. It's in the right place. This, this 2 goes to 2 star is there to the, no. Where is it? There's one recurrence. 0 to 0, yeah, I guess. Yeah, but very little is known about the metric. So you're sort of Fourier transforming the metric, right, when you go to high mass, and we don't have high mass.
Why couldn't you take the lattice data?
Okay, you're getting a little ahead of me. I will try to make that case, that you might be able to do something in the direction, but clearly it's very difficult. Okay, so the other thing which I think is interesting to look at in terms of lattice data, and in fact more revealing than the glue balls themselves, is to look at the fluctuations of a flux tube. So I'll give you the Yang-Mills picture. Here's a heavy quark and a heavy anti-quark, and presumably it makes some flux tubes that looks like this, and this is supposed to be 4D Yang-Mills. And now in the case of this ADS picture where we have some min here, well, I'm drawing it too big and hard to draw. We introduce heavy quarks as sources at r equals zero, r equals infinity, at the surface. And then you can find the minimal surface that spans this. And in fact, if you take them farther apart, I'm not going to be able to do it, the minimal surface finally comes down like that. And indeed, the fact that it has this minimum means that the minimum surface has energy proportional to the separation here, approximately, as we pull them apart. And that's the famous statement that if you have a sufficient distortion in the metric to stop this minimal surface from just going out and spreading as it does in the conformal theory, you'll actually get linear confinement, which is essentially why those trajectories were linear. What's interesting here is not just the fact that you can get the so-called area law, that's the ground state, but there also are fluctuations of that string between heavy quarks. And indeed, in fact, we even have probably an approximation to that. If we look at top quarks rotating slowly around, they are essentially static on the time scale of the flux tube between them. And in fact, people are using the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, which says the static quarks move slowly like this, and they equilibrate at every point the glue that sits in between them. So that's almost an experimental setup for it. But again, the lattice can make any kind of geometrical setup it wants and then investigate the spectrum. So why is the spectrum interesting? Well, the spectrum's interesting because as L goes to 0, you're out here where these models are ADS space. And they have something like the right, not quite right, ultraviolet behavior. When L gets large, they're investigating the large distance properties when the flux tube is pulled out a long ways. So this is, in some sense, a kind of microscope using this L, where you can investigate length scales. And so here, by the way, is a map of the action density for this four-dimensional QQ bar pair. Just a picture, show you what it looks like. Lots of gluonic excitations here, and here's the tube quite nicely being shown. That's a lattice calculation, obviously. SU2, in fact. Okay, here is the spectrum of the string normal modes when you hold the ends completely still. Infinite mass, quark, or actually just 3-3 bar, no spin. Here is the ground state. This is Coulomb's law at short distances. Here is the linear potential as you go out. The distance here, by the way, is, I think this is about a, yeah, this is about a half a Fermi in these units. So this is a Fermi here. Well, I'm sorry. Yeah, this is a Fermi here. Strain units that people use in this. So here is the ground state, and that is what's so-called confinement or area law. Here is the next excitation state, like that, and an the first excitation is the string obviously just excited into a single arc with no node and fluctuating back and forth. It can fluctuate in the x or y plane if I choose this to be the z axis. So I choose my quarks in the axis and it's a jump rope and it can fluctuate this way or it can fluctuate this way. Or more sensibly, it can have circular polarization by spinning this way or this way. So it has a helicity down the line. Okay. So this is actually a doubly degenerate state, but it's exactly degenerate. Here are the excitations and so on of the spectrum. This is a lot of data.
What exactly are you looking at? So R is this?
I'm plotting. No, this is lattice data. This is lattice.
Why does the mass depend on the distance?
I take a quark and make it go on a fixed time direction. This is done in a four-dimensional lattice. At a distance L, and I find the eigenvalues of that propagating state.
So LSR. Yeah.
Oh, so LSR. Yeah, LSR. Yeah, people
too.
Yeah, you take a piece of data here, 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 here. You have to do it over and over again. It's a lot of work. But look, anyway, look at all of this very nice spectrum. Up here, it's telling you something very simple. It's telling you that, and when you stretch the string a long distance, it becomes essentially a it becomes a simple quadratic action. This has, by the way, been analyzed in effective theories by Lucier and in great detail. Essentially, any theory of flux tubes, when you pull them far enough apart, looks like a massless string or tension per unit length, and you get a spectrum. And this spectrum will turn out to be it will have a ground state like this, and then the excitation energies, delta E, will in fact eventually be n pi over L, which is just the harmonic modes of a string of separation L. And indeed, if you write down this NAMBU action, you can recompute that in a second, okay? And this is getting asymptotically close to that. You'd have to go even farther to get that perfect spacing. And indeed, all the states are classified by the oscillator description, where this is the first level, second level, first oscillator, second oscillator, third oscillator, and they're put into helicity combinations by taking x of xa plus minus I xy. And then you do this for level one, this is level one, level two, and so on.
This is just NAMBU string and...
This classification this is just a NAMBU string in 3 plus 1 dimensions. If you classify the states by their quantum numbers, which have a parity of reversal and the silicity, this is actually chemist notation for the quantum numbers. I will go through it.
Is there any degree with the string and because there is a sphere, and then if you do string in this model of confinement
theory? Well, I'm just saying that, we can get to that. But out here, it's essentially a theorem that as you go out to infinite separation, it will agree with a NAMBU string.
In 4 dimensions.
Yes, a NAMBU string in 4 dimensions. If you stretch a string physically, only the endpoints break the symmetry of where the string ought to be. So these really are would-be Goldstone modes on a finite interval. And so there is a spectrum which is collapsing, which is the translation modes of the string from their fixed points. The other spectrum is higher, okay? So there is a universal spectrum which is collapsing down like 1 over L. And it's really hard to see how you'll get anything but this in anybody's string theory if it's going to eventually look like a geometrical string in 4 dimensions.
But in these models, you also have a 5-sphere or 6-sphere or something like that. And the whole point of
lattice cage theory you're talking about. That was a different part of the
talk. I'm on lattice cage theory now, okay?
But that's supposed.
I know. Let me try to bring them together. No, I agree. There'll be other states in the 5-sphere. Sure. Okay. Although those states will be set by the radius of that sphere and will have gaps. No. We should discuss this. We should discuss this. But I agree. I'm not investigating this in a given model. Okay. All right. So let me go on. Okay. So anyway, the states are classified by these symmetries of these oscillator states. They are not fitting the NAMBU string because look at all the structure, okay? And in fact, here, blowing it up shows you how much these things go from the even spacing law to a reorganization. And indeed, I didn't say, but because I'm running out of time, the glue ball calculations have been crudely understood for a long time in terms of sort of bag picture of cavity oscillations of weak fields. A similar thing can be done here when the QQ bar gets close together and you basically have a cavity with the charges almost sitting on top of each other in very simple symmetries. And this coalition into reorganized points can be crudely understood that way. So there is a huge reorganization from these harmonic modes out at long distances and reorganization at short distances. Compute these curves in the right theory, and we'll know it's the right theory, I claim. That's my political comment. Okay, now, what can you do? Well, we have actually tried to do this. Let me just remind you, here is the NAMBU string. This is the question that you're asking. Putting it only in arbitrary dimensions, so it's not a critical string. Just look at it. Here is the exact solution to that quantized string. Here is the large L expansion. This is the modes that I was speaking about for this even spacing. This is the so-called Luscher term, or central charge term, which is universal in a theory of this kind. That fits only asymptotically for very large L. We have been modeling this in a background like the one I was talking about for the glue balls. We modify the metric by cutting it off smoothly in some way at Rmin. If you do that, you can recompute these things. And I won't bore you with it, but I'll tell you one thing that happens here. This is the ground state energy in this cutoff. And this is your point that it's probably not too sensitive to the exact shape of it, okay? But the ground state energy in the presence of that cutoff, when the string is way out at short distances, it must be 1 over L looking like Coulomb's law. It's actually conformal. And when it's at long distances, it must be linear. There's two parameters in this theory. There is the slope, or Reggie slope, or coupling constant, if you like. And there is the, there's two parameters. There's the string length and the coupling constant. Because you have two parameters in this theory, which you shouldn't have in QCD, there should be a relationship between the coupling constant and the slope. I have two parameters to fit a curve. I ought to be fitting with one. So that's why I can get such a good fit. But nonetheless, this fit, believe it or not, the straight line is the best fit through the lattice data, and the crosses are my numerical integration of this ground state energy. And you cannot tell the difference. I mean, it's extraordinary how good a fit it is, which just shows maybe you don't learn very much from the ground state, I mean, about this curved space. I think almost anything decent would have done a decent fit to it. Now, what you really want to do, by the way, let me show you. Here is Luescher's very careful fit to this Luescher term. And this is the statement. This line here is the prediction for this universal term in four dimensions. This is the prediction for the universal term in three dimensions. I think it's very interesting that he can actually see this effect. It's paradoxical that he can see it because he's measuring the string only separated by around a half a Fermi to a Fermi. And I remind you where he's doing this. There's a paradox here that he is measuring. Well, I have to go back one more. He is finding the Luescher term by investigating the string stretched very accurately here and measuring extremely accurately this. But look at the tangle of levels, which in the naive sort of normal ordering argument adds up to this Luescher term. It doesn't look anything like the levels here. So this has caused a huge internal debate in the lattice community. What the heck is going on? Why should he get anything like the answer that you would naively get from infinite L from this region when it's that tangle of levels? And the answer is, I don't know. But I just tell you it is a paradox that he's getting the right answer, apparently. Now, I want to just mention one other thing. The really interesting thing is to see the deviation of these levels relative to the naive asymptotic behavior given by this, right? So in other words, this is the departure of the QCD string from the naive Nambu string, okay? There is a definite departure. Chingyi, who is at Brown, and I have been actually using this background to compute these deviations. And we get qualitatively this kind of deviation from the background. We do see curves that come down like this about this way. You know, the background is somewhat arbitrary. The integration scheme isn't quite perfect, but it's getting there. But all I can tell you is that, again, we're getting qualitatively right physics. And indeed, Charles has been pushing us to look at the extreme limit of L small, where it becomes exactly ADS. And there, you can actually, again, compute the level spacing. And it turns out to be about here, about 0.5. One has to be careful, it's a little dependent on n. But it falls by about half from the infinite L exact answer that would be here and the zero L conformal theory. And so this fall of a half seems to be phenomenologically reasonable, okay, for whatever reason. Now, there is some distinction between the quantum numbers and the levels, which I wouldn't pretend to understand. So I'll leave you with what I think is, you know, everybody agree, the big open problem. How do we find the model which has the right microscopic degrees of freedom? So we don't keep pushing things around qualitatively and saying, it looks QCD-like, it's got confinement. That we've done that for the last 5 years, and it's great. I'm happy to have been witness this clearly increased qualitative understanding. But here, this should help us dig out the actual microscopic variables that sit on the string, which I think most of us feel will probably have some fermions, which are what came from the supersymmetry theory, which got distorted. But maybe if you look at the spectrum very carefully, the way people did atomic physics and nuclear physics or whatever, one can be an experimentalist in this field and look for the microscopic structure and try to find out what is the effective QCD string before someone brilliant writes it all down. Okay? This would not be unusual to use data to get a leg up, okay? So I think there is a chance here to kind of return to the sort of original 60s attitude that we have a phenomenology here. We're looking for a microscopic theory. We don't know what it is. Thank you.